bigger pictures and then very tiny pictures. You could take a table if you want.
Here's a spot. Michael,
now, I couldn't find my my best maps. We've moved too many times and things have been in storage and I'm not really sure what happened to them. So I actually borrowed from Dahlia. I wanted to just, I know everybody knows what the world looks like, but I brought this bigger map this morning to deal with Israel on the axis point. You know, we talk about this country as being the land bridge between Africa and Asia, Asia Minor, Europe. But it's also on a really critical, pivotal point. It's on an axis point. And a lot of European countries especially, in the last 400 or 500 years, have wanted to make sure they control an overland or shipping passageway to India. So India is our main focus today. The trade routes that come from, you know, Tibet, Nepal, Persia, the Kashmir, northern India, southern India, Sri Lanka, all kinds of materials from that country made their way through Arabia, made their way through the Negev, made their way to Gaza, and from Gaza they would go to all kinds of ports, Alexandria, Rome, you name it. And everybody wants to control this spice route, right? It's the most lucrative thing on the map in ancient times, and it's still, in some ways, it's still lucrative and it's still flowing. It's still not necessarily an overland passage today, but the Suez Canal and shipping and flight carriers definitely bringing wealth from India to all kinds of places. So I wanted to kind of get the bigger map going, and then I'm going to take this off and deal with more particulars to where we are. This is not supposed to be incredibly accurate, all right? So here we have Gaza. And over here, kind of off the map, we've got the Nile, Alexandria. And I'm going to just roughly draw, you know, the Sinai Peninsula. This is not accurate, all right? I've already said that, haven't I?
I have a question. It's not being taped, it's all right.
That's all given, don't worry.
Yeah.
Just that.
You see, you can't tape this.
You can do it.
So, what I wanted to deal with this morning, I'm a big fan of the spice route, and I think it's because that's the area where the Bible came to life for me for the very first time. I got the privilege of volunteering and working on two or three sort of emergency surveys. You guys can come to the table. One of the first places I got to volunteer at in 1982 was a place called Horvat Chalukim. It's near Stable Care. It's just right by Avdat, ancient Avdat, Ovoda. I got to work in the Machtesh Ramon on a site, a caravan sarai that was not a farm, but we were serving it as if it might have been a farm for Nabataean people. And while we were there, I was a believer, but I really hadn't immersed myself in scripture. And the only thing I took to read with me during these 6 months of field exercises was this particular Bible. And the very first thing I ever read, outside of sort of the salvation verses that I had found, were, you know, I opened up, well, there's Jeremiah. I knew nothing about Jeremiah. I'm just going to read Jeremiah. And while I was reading, I ended up reading about
more or less places in the Negev that we were working on, places that had been abandoned, places that had been destroyed and forgotten, and places that would be were sort of promised from Jeremiah 30, 31, 32, 33. You get into this restoration section where the fields will be bought and sold again in the Negev, silver, gold, you know, cities will be rebuilt, things like that. Well, that's what we were working on.
Vineyards on the mountains.
Vineyards, produce, trade, buying and selling, new life. Okay, so it's very, very beautiful language. I encourage everybody to read. Well, first you read Jeremiah 13 because you get some of the warnings and the desperate scenes that happen here. But then the restoration passages, which start quite painfully, you know, the troubles of Jacob and suffering, and then it becomes quite beautiful. So those are the passages that really inspired me. And I was working on a farm. Ein Saharonim, it's in the Machtesh Ramon. It's just a spring with a little caravan stop. Very beautiful setting, very, very picturesque, and also a very lonely place just out in the middle of nowhere. And I was there for 2 weeks. And you know, they have this loess dust, it's everywhere. It gets in your hair, gets in your food, and you know, you don't have to shower, you know, nobody's concerned about water. But the nice thing about loess in your hair is you take a little bit of water and you go like that, and your hair is sculpted for weeks. You don't have to do anything for weeks. It's just, yeah, it's really great. So while I was there, I bump into these restoration passages. And I also was working with a believer. His name was Hendrik Braun, Bruins. Hendrik Bruins, Nomi Bruins' father, Nomi Bruins Jones. And his project was called Ancient Israelite Desert Farming Research Project, or AIDFARP for short. And I've always enjoyed the fact that I got to be a part of AIDFARP, because on your resume, that looks quite nice. AIDFARP. While I was there, of course, a lot of Exodus themes and subjects from the book of Deuteronomy and Numbers, knowing that we weren't far from the wilderness of Paran, for example. We were kind of in between the Midbar Tzin and Paran, kind of in that Machtesh Ramon, which is just a fantastic sight. I love the wilderness settings.
Which is a big crater.
It's a big crater. And while I was there, I also started picking up on these ideas. Well, you know, the Israelim of ancient times wandered through here. Israelites, you know, maybe they camped through here. The Nabataean spice route wasn't something new. It was quite an ancient trade route, and Israelites may have been on that at some points, you know. So my mind was really racing, and it's been motivational ever since. So today, I thought I would deal with superpowers that have tried to take over this spice route and control it. And I want to deal with some of the mysterious items listed in the book of Exodus and elsewhere, but that are certainly not found in the Sinai. All right?
He was not here for the 2 times that you said, this map's not
accurate. The map is now representative of something more accurate. All right. Things that are found in the book of Exodus, but they don't really belong in the Sinai. So, and this kind of ties in with today's parasha, which has to do with holiness. When you start reading along through the book of Exodus, and let's say you get into chapters 23, 24, 25 through 30, you get all kinds of things that are listed that really don't belong, especially if we have the Israelites down here in the tip of the Sinai, somewhere in there. And I'm not opposed to it at all. I don't have an axe to grind necessarily. But if they're down in there, boy, there is really, if, if any of you have ever been to the Sinai, any part of the Sinai, you realize there's very, very limited farming potential unless you have some kind of good well or a spring. There's very, very limited possibilities for farming. You have to basically get up to the northern frontiers of the Sinai where it borders the Negev before you have any chance, before you have enough rainfall. And yet you have all kinds of things listed, you know, like fields, wheat, grain, olives, olive oil, linen. Well, to have good linen, you need good flax. And, you know, good flax requires a good farm and good conditions. There's too many things listed that conceivably would be hard to bring out of Egypt. You would have to have oil tankers coming out of Egypt to bring all the oil that would be necessary. Too many things listed in too much abundance. So let's just start with things like carnelian. And I brought a little example of what is possibly carnelian or amber. And this is a signet ring. I can't really date it 100%, but I know it's got to be somewhere between 2nd century, more or less, AD. It could be as much as 2nd, 3rd centuries BC. I really shouldn't even own it. I found it a dot between part of the excavated areas of the
stunning
caravanserai and the Roman camp, along with a few dozen coins that I really shouldn't have either.
We won't be putting this online.
I know.
I never told you I was on the cover.
All right, so at first I thought we had that it was a little image of Athena on the back, which would make sense. There's quite an abundance of women and Athena, especially Seleucid period. If you go and you research signet rings on with amber or carnelian, you find it's a pretty frequent image to have a woman, a goddess, or the wife of some Seleucid or Ptolemaic king, right? But in this case, I'm not sure what we have. It's an image of a person, and the hand is kind of making a symbol, a gesture. I'm really not sure, but at first when I saw it, I thought, well, some high school teenager has dropped, you know, an earring, and it's probably plastic. And the more I looked at it, I realized, well, that looks like amber, and because there's a lot of impurities inside it. And then I went to the Israel Museum, actually talked to some people, and I found a selection of signet rings. Now, this is the old one before the museum got rearranged. Today, they only have two signet rings like that on display, but there used to be a whole selection of them. And I found some that were very similar to mine. And that's why I was more confident with the dating. I thought, well, you know, there is 2nd century AD to 2nd century BC. It fits in there with others that I'm seeing like this. Is this Odem? Is this stone Odem of the book of Exodus, chapter 28, verse 17? If it's carnelian, it has a strong chance. Carnelian or sard, which is a harder version of carnelian. I'm not a geologist, but it is a passionate pastime. A semi-precious gemstone like sard. Both varieties are of the silica mineral chalcedony, which has typical impurities of iron oxide. They're mostly found in Brazil, Siberia, and India.
Which one is it?
Sard or Odem. And in Hebrew, Odem could cover both sard and carnelian.
Tell them what Odem sounds like.
It sounds like a dome. And it should be
redness.
Red. There should be some red coloring in there. It's translated as sardius in Greek, in the Septuagint, which I assume is based on the word sard. Sard is a pretty common word for this harder carnelian. It could have been on the choshen. It could have been on the breastplate, one of the first rows of stones on the high priestly breastplate, something like that. You can take it out of the plastic if you can't see the little...
I did inside. It's just beautiful.
I didn't see the figure. I just saw it.
Now, I've never tried this, so I don't have experience. But when it comes to signet rings and stamping them into hot wax or warm wax, I found one of the bonus points for carnelian is that the hot wax doesn't stick to it. So that might have been one of the reasons why it is a choice material for signet rings. Okay, so carnelian, it doesn't belong in the Sinai. It doesn't belong in the Negev. It doesn't belong in Egypt, apparently. It is most likely coming from India. And, you know, I'm just going to give it a 90% chance of some of the stuff that would be coming out of India and not Europe.
All the way from India, wow.
Yes.
And is it expensive in big quantities? Like, can you only find it in, like, very small quantities? Or
that I don't know.
Oh.
I know there's a little bit in Germany, too.
How old is this stone, then?
Well... I'm just putting it in a window of 2nd century AD to 2nd century BC, somewhere in there, because it matched others like it from that same period. What I can't prove is if it's truly carnelian or if it's amber. And the impurities in there, to me, looks like more like amber. All right, a second item, frankincense. It's mentioned in Exodus 30, verse 34. I'll read it in English. Then the Lord said to Moses, take for yourself spices, items, I'm not even sure what they are, onica, galbanum, spices with pure frankincense. There shall be an equal part of each. Nataf, Nataf sounds like a drip, a drop. I don't know what Samim Nataf and I do know Livuna.
Which is Nataf?
Livuna is probably frankincense. But some of these others, like this gum resin, is just listed as Nataf.
Are you talking about frankincense?
Exodus 30, verse 34.
Yeah.
And then another common one, myrrh. I'm not trying to suggest that, you know, all of these only come from India. Frankincense is certainly one of those that does. But myrrh is grown in quite a few places. So Exodus 30, verse 23. It's listed as Mar Doror. And then there's theories, is that Mar something bitter, a resin from some plant? Is it something that is swallowed? What is Doror? Freedom, you know, it has lots of nice meaning. Some people even suggest it, some part of the letter is dropped off. It should be Drom. I don't know. I'm out of my comfort zone to make suggestions like that. But many people look at myrrh, which is a little bit like frankincense, and it is the sap of a plant that can be baked, ground down. You can create an oil out of it. People use it for perfumes, medicine, incense. I've got a couple texts where it was used by ancient Egyptians as part of their embalming mixture, probably because it had a nice fragrance, nice aroma. It can be ingested by mixing it with wine for medicinal purposes. Some believe it is the ancient balsam of Mecca or the balm of Gilead. So myrrh in Arabic, mur.
What's the word in Hebrew?
Mar.
So, mar or mar. What's the regular spice that you buy in the shops, which has got a very similar word? I get incredibly muddled with all the sort of, I don't know. Molly, what are the spices that one buys in the shops? The dry green spices.
Marjoram?
No, marjoram is an oregano. It doesn't matter.
Zatar, thyme.
Yes, all these things. Dill. What's dill in Hebrew?
It's shamir.
Shamir. Okay. Well, there's a. Anyway, it must be something like this.
So.
Yes. Before you go on, the gum resin.
Yes.
Is something that grows, especially in southern Egypt, south of Egypt, out in the what would have been Nubia.
Well,
the gum Arabic today is one of the major exports of Sudan.
Absolutely. And we've got it apparently in what used to be Eritrea, Somalia, modern Yemen, and Ethiopia apparently. So it's and it could have been even in the mountains of Gilead, you know. I really don't know. Myrrh is one of those things that you know you go to the spice market today, whether you're in Istanbul or in the old city, and they got, you know, big piles of frankincense and myrrh, and they look very similar, and one's a little lighter, one's a little darker. But I don't know if we're talking about the same things, to be honest. So I get kind of muddled in this. So I'm going to try to stay on the surface as much as possible. But again, I'm going to say it's not. These are not substances that you readily find in the Sinai. Okay.
And also, they were brought from the east when the quotes kings, whatever, came to visit Jesus the baby.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm going to touch on that.
Right.
All right. Then we have different types of myrrh. Some are native to Yemen, Somalia, Eritrea, Eastern Ethiopia. I think I'll leave that for now. I've got items like cumin. Of course, it's not mentioned in Exodus, but it is mentioned in the book of Isaiah. It's mentioned in Matthew. Today, India still produces about 70% of the world's supply of cumin. If I could have titled this with one word, I would have used the word spikenard. I think it's my favorite. Nard, nardin, muskroot, spikenard is a flowering plant from the Himalayas, Nepal, China, and India. The roots of this plant can be crushed and distilled into an amber-colored essential oil. The Greeks knew nardos as lavender, so I'm not 100% sure if lavender is or isn't, but the scent of spikenard attracts cats, which is a phenomenon in and of itself. But we have spikenard listed in Mark chapter 14. Jesus was in Bethany in the house of Simon the leper. He sat at the table. A woman came with an alabaster flask, a very costly oil made of spikenard. She broke the flask and poured it on his head. So a very expensive thing, a very valuable thing.
If you'll let me with a light comment.
Sure.
The fact that the hakul is never mentioned in the Bible means that you can't suggest this spice.
Okay, I won't suggest this spice.
But the plant, catnip, which grows all over English gardens, does attract cats, and it's very, very similar to lavender to look at.
But by the fact that
and you can buy it dry, I've got it, you put it on the right place, and it makes the cats scratch there rather than scratch everywhere else. I have a pot of it at home.
I don't mean that there were not cats here.
Oh, I know.
It's a joke.
That was a joke.
It never didn't make it in the Bible.
Yeah. Well,
maybe they had people.
Bigger cats made it in the Bible.
The bigger cats made it into the Bible.
Named made it. The little cats made it on frescoes and artwork in Egypt, so I know they're around.
Oh, really?
They were around.
Okay.
What did you say?
The elephant didn't make any Bible either.
No, but...
And we knew they were around.
They were definitely around.
In the room. In the
So when
they're in the room, but you can't see them.
That's right.
Aren't they mentioned in the books of Maccabee, though?
They
are. That's close enough. That's
they are in the book of Maccabee.
Yeah.
Dude's dad's an elephant.
Peter Rabbit. That's right. In the Bible.
And what about that terrible thing about the elephant shit in that paper you had to read?
No, that was something Michael read. That was an Aramaic scroll.
Aramaic eyes.
Okay, this is not going online. All right.
Okay. Keep going.
All right, keep going.
Speaking of cats, this is sort of like herding cats, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I'm throwing out a verse, Song of Solomon, chapter 4, verse 14. Nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all the trees of frankincense, myrrh, and aloes, along with the finest spices. This verse sums up, I think, a lot of what is going on in the book of Exodus when we're dealing with... This period in the chapter in the Israelites wondering where they are becoming a factory and they're developing things, materials for the tabernacle. So I'm actually coming to the tabernacle at some point.
Is it Song of Solomon?
Song of Solomon 4, verse 14. So saffron is mentioned, which could be, you know, it comes from all over the place. It comes from Persia, Southwest Asia, possibly parts of Greece. It comes from a flower, and you know, a crocus. There's references, you know, all over the place. Physicians in Gaza used it for ointments and aromatic waters, perfumes and potpourris, mascaras, divine offerings and medicinal treatments. BC stuff. So saffron is definitely out there. It's playing a role in this spice trade.
And nard, you say, is either spike nard or lavender.
It could, well, the Greeks call
it. I've just got the translation of nard.
Nardos as lavender.
Right.
How does one tell saffron from curcum?
I don't know, because curcum is the word that is used in Hebrew.
Curcum is
turmeric. Well, how far is the turmeric from the saffron?
I assume they're two different plants.
Very much, because the turmeric is yellow.
It's more of a root, isn't it? Is
no,
the turmeric like
yellow.
A root?
Well, it's but the it turns yellow, but the seed, the thing itself is actually red. The little stem from the coccus is red, but it turns into yellow. But it's in strands. The other ones are powdered. Yeah.
Curcum will get added to mustard. But
I assume
saffron is only added to rice.
Rice and bread. Any of you ever had saffron with rice?
Yes.
It's very tasty.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very nice.
It's fine. I make it all the time. I'm just made it less sweet.
That's because you live here and it's cheaper here.
Because I live so many years in Spain. It's a national dish.
So I'm not going to be able to commit myself. Is saffron, curcum?
Oh, I'm assuming they're not. No.
I don't know.
I just was adding an extra spice and saying that if you put some powder in front of me and said, is that turmeric or saffron, I wouldn't have a clue.
Right.
It's like what Don said. Saffron is the little stem, and it looks like little stems. But the turmeric is powdered. It's very yellowish.
But turmeric comes from something that's a little bit more like curry. It's more like a root-looking thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, just curry.
Curry is just a mixture of spices.
That's all it is.
That's all it means.
Just
that's all it means.
Curry could be lots of different kinds of mixtures.
That's right. You could make anything.
Yeah, there's lots of kinds of curries.
What? Vindaloo?
Chicken curry. Cat curry.
Green curry, yellow curry, red curry.
Yeah.
You have to be courageous to try any of them. Okay. We're moving on. I'm throwing out another one that is listed this time in the book of Exodus as well. Coriander. One of the oldest archaeological finds that included coriander seed was at a cave near the Dead Sea, Nahal Hemel, where several liters of seed pods were found, as well as another big find in King Tut's tomb. So you're talking about, you know, 3,500-year-old seed pods in King Tut's tomb. That's a pretty significant thing.
Also, is it coriander when you grow it, the plant is cilantro?
Yeah, see, and this is another one that is a little bit vague to me. Are we talking about cilantro? Because well, if we are, it grows all over the place. It's all over the Middle East.
Usually fresh, it would be cilantro, but the seeds is coriander seeds, and you also use that as a spice.
Right.
But as I understand, in David's archaeological dig there from the whoever, they found in the toilet, they found poop, and then the poop was cilantro and parsley.
And parsley. Yeah. And that's interesting. Well, we've just killed the appetite. Whatever was
ruminating has disappeared.
All right.
Now I know the reason that he doesn't want to put this online.
Yeah. Well, coriander, the coriander seed looked like man. See, because the Israelites, they look at man, and they say, man who? What is it? You know, man, it's like kizera, God. The word God, it's kind of a curious thing. It's a tribal name, coriander seed. At any rate, I don't know where coriander originates, because it's all over the place. I went online, I tried to find, you know, evidence of coriander and cilantro. It's all over the place. There's Chinese varieties, there's Sri Lankan varieties, there's Arabian varieties. It's everywhere. It's in Europe, it's in Greece. So I don't know. I just think it's interesting that it's listed here, and it even sort of...
It's in Southern California.
It's in salsa. All right.
So this whole thing could have been happening in Southern California.
This whole thing.
And this
Imperial,
whole delusion.
The Imperial Valley could have been the sign.
Yeah. So this Middle East delusion and Israel being the center of the world is all delusional.
It's all delusional. Bedolach. Bedelium.
Bedelium, yeah.
Is an aromatic gum-like myrrh that's mentioned in Numbers 11:7. Manna was like coriander seed in its appearance, also like bdellium. Bedolach. Greek. It has a crystal-like look, and it's called krustalu. I kind of like that. Then we have another reference
that's
to...
also today, bdolach in Hebrew today is used for crystals. Mm-hmm. It always Dola. Helps to get the Hebrew word in there besides the Latin ones, because nobody knows what the Latin ones
no.
are.
Now we have another Dola. One.
What? Dolach.
Yeah. Kristallnacht.
Okay, it's right from...
No, I lost that. What did you say?
Kristallnacht. Leila Dolach.
Oh. Oh, my God. Dolach.
Exodus 30, verse 24. Something called Kedah. The head or the flower of a plant. It's quite common in East Asia. Sometimes it's called Chinese cinnamon. And related to true cinnamon from Sri Lanka, Chinese cinnamon is largely marketed in the U.S. today, which I was a little bit surprised to find. There's lots of different varieties of cinnamon, darker, lighter versions. We may have a reference to something called cassia in Exodus 30, verse 24, kedah in the Hebrew, and they wanted chamishmilt, you know, shekels worth of this stuff, along with Shemen Zait and so forth. Anyway, it's an interesting reference. Kedah, whatever this is, Chinese cinnamon, is also not from the Negev, it's not from the Sinai. These are the points I'm making. I want to go back to the Song of Solomon verse 4:14, where it lists nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon. But throughout this idea, cinnamon is a really fascinating subject. I think I got lost in cinnamon when I was doing the research. It was so fascinating because there's so many things it's used for, and it was so valuable at certain times of history. The Romans were willing to pay up to 10 months' labor or wage, 300 denarii, just to buy 327 grams, if this calculation is right, of cinnamon. 327 grams could cost you 10 months' wage. Now, it's according to Pliny the Elder that the Roman pound, 327 grams, or 11.5 ounces of cassia or cinnamon, could cost up to 300 denarii.
That's an expensive cinnamon bun.
It's imported to Egypt as early as 2000 BC. It's listed for lots of uses. Its aroma, obviously, and in cooking, in probably embalming, and also in ointments and things that were used for holy men, priests. The priestly garments are made with cinnamon in the dipping, and it's something that had nice fragrance. It's listed in the Keturah. It's part of the Keturah, the concoction that we're using in the tabernacle and in the temple, the incense and things like that. I'm sure it was a great fragrance. I'm sure it was a great smell to enjoy, if smells can be good. So, cinnamon, it's listed in the book of Exodus. Where is my verse? Kenamon. It's right there in verse 23. See, Exodus 30, verse 23. Exodus 30, verse 23. Take for yourself the finest of spices, flowering myrrh, 500 shekels, and fragrant cinnamon, or, you know, pure cinnamon, half as much, 250 weights or shekels, and fragrant cane, and so forth. So it's listed as part of some very fragrant things that are put together into an anointing type of oil and incense. So I'm fascinated with cinnamon. Let me push on kind of quickly because I don't want to run out of time here. The Ketoret, the Katar, I burn incense. It's made with things that come from faraway places. Most of it doesn't come from Egypt. Most of it doesn't come from Africa. Most of it is coming from India. So I'm dealing with this, the overland passage. I'm dealing with the waterway passages to bring spices, to bring valuable things. Gold is included too, silver and gold. Egypt has its own sources of gold and silver, but there's a lot of gold coming out of India. So when we talk about gold, frankincense, and myrrh, that well-known passage in the Gospels, reference in the Gospels, we know where these things are coming from the most part. They're coming from much further east. And we've had a host of superpowers trying to control this thing. I've been watching a series on how World War I got started, and the years leading up to World War I. It's just a fascinating thing, but everybody is trying to control this overland passage.
Right.
You know, you've got the Portuguese, you've got Spaniards, you've got Germans, you've got British, you've got French. Everybody has started up an East India trade company, you know, in the 16th and 17th centuries. Everybody's trying to angle in on this valuable thing. I've got quotes from British statesmen that talk about, you know, if this is the strength of England, we have to make sure we control this.
Absolutely.
In 1870s, they're already making statements like, this is the strength of our country. We can't let this overland passage...
The trade route to India was the crucial issue. for the British.
It's why we have Lawrence of Arabia, you know, trying to make sure he's making deals with locals so we can keep this thing. It's why they make the Balfour Declaration. The Jewish people sitting in here would be loyal to Britain, and they would probably allow this thing to keep flowing. The Germans want it. Napoleon wanted it. Admiral Nelson stopped Napoleon in 1798. Napoleon was after it as well. Everybody's after it. Germans. So I think everybody was after it in ancient times too. The Egyptians were after it. Everybody and their dog. The Mitanni, the Hittites, you name it. I know Israel is this overland passage, and it's we think of its value is in much different terms, but on a practical level, this land bridge is something to control.
Can I tell you what I read just this week, a couple of days ago, that the Chinese are now funding a new land route from Eilat to
Ashdod,
you're right. They're up to Ashdod because they're scared with the present situation that they're going to lose the Suez Canal. So it's the Chinese are funding it. And the Chinese, not industry, what's the word I want, export relationship with Israel is now as great, if not greater, than with Europe. Because Europe is becoming more and more anti-Israel and will go down that path more and more with the present situation. And China is taking over.
So David Ben-Gurion was something of a prophet because he said that Israel's future was in the Negev, in the south, and was with Eastern connections.
He's right. He's right.
I want to get back on target here. I lost my way just a little bit. But when you're reading through these passages of Exodus, 23, 24, 25 through 30, you get all these other ideas like, you know, you shall sow your land for 6 years and gather in its yield. Well, they're out in the middle of a
bloody desert.
That's right. Who's sowing crops? What are they talking about? Or is it just so you know what to do when you enter the land? No, it's like, you know, you're sowing crops, you're letting fields lie fallow, you're following certain rules so that the needy people may eat. You leave the corner. They're talking about this in the middle of the desert. So
which is it, Johnny? Is it for now in the middle of the desert, or is it for when I take you into the land that you have promised you?
Well, I'm trying to deal with the more practical side first. The practical side is that they've got materials. They've got lots of materials. And they have farming going on. They've got cinnamon, for goodness sake. They're sitting right smack dab on the spice trail. And this is why I wanted to get to, this is what I'm trying to get to.
I'm going to suggest, and I'm not an expert, obviously, I'm going to suggest that most of the Israelite presence in that 40-year period is going to be in this range here. Just a little bit south of Beersheba, Arad, a little bit south of what we call the Negev of ancient times. The Negev is just southern dry parts of Judea, right? I'm going to say the Israelites, most of their 40 years is in this pocket, which is going to include, I don't know if you've been south to like Avdat, there is water. And even Kadesh Barnea, there's a little bit of water. There's a little bit of farming. Even if you go to Google Earth and you zoom in on the area of Kadesh Barnea, you'll notice farms. There's a little bit of runoff agriculture going on there. There was runoff agriculture in ancient times too. I worked on one site called Chorvat Chalukim. And one of the things they noticed about the site, it's just 2 minutes north of Stable Care. 2 minutes north. And it's just a little nachal, it's a little wadi with lots of terraces in it, ancient terraces. And we, part of the excavation, we uncovered all kinds of pottery and things that would be a couple thousand years old and older. And then later they came back and they did what is called soil memory testing, where they take everything to the lab, everything which would have patina growing on, every little bit of soil, and they analyze things and they find out that farm was being used
3,000 BC, not just a couple thousand years ago. We have to push it back, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 years. So there was active farming going on around the area of Midbar, Tzin, Avdat, a lot of farming. If you've ever gone to Avdat, you'll notice there's olive crushing stones, there's wine presses, big ones. Avdat has one of the biggest wine presses in the whole area. And you look out and, you know, you look at the landscapes, it's just dry and barren, but you can see the evidence of old terraces from Nabataean times and so forth. So I'm going to suggest that the Israelites are actually engaged in farming during that 40-year period. They're not just sitting twiddling their thumbs. Manna, you know, is definitely coming, is falling, but they're also working. I'm going to suggest that they are farming and they are already practicing these biblical rules that apply to once they enter Canaan. They're already using them in the wilderness. So this idea of beaten oil and bringing in grains and all kinds of linen, flaxseed materials, they're already farming. They're already set in for a fairly long haul right there in the next central Negev. And the reason I'm pushing this is because you have to ask yourselves, Exodus chapter 17, why did Amalek come out and attack Israel?
My question exactly. Great. Good.
Why did he do it? Well, there's obviously we have, you know, grumbling and complaining and fighting in the waters of, you know, Meribah and so forth. We've got grumbling and complaining, so we can say spiritually we know why Amalek comes out and attacks. But Amalek is also doing his job. He's got interference right in the middle of the wealthy spice trade. I think, doesn't Amalek originally come from the Negev, southern Judea?
It appears that way.
I would say so. So he's up here, probably got a lot of area of control under his responsibility. And here's the Israelites, right smack in the middle of the trade. He's got to come out and do something because that's all their money. All their income, all their wealth is, you know, hinging on this.
Remember when David fought them, it was down there in the southern Negev, and it says that, you know, we chased 600 of these Amalekim, and we wiped them all out. No one escaped. Well, 400 of them got away.
Yeah.
You do the math and you go, wow, what a way to tell a story. We got them all. Only 2 out of 3 got away.
The other thing is, I mean, I don't know, does Amalek know that Moses has got water going there down there?
I don't know.
I mean, maybe he's also coming in, not only...
It comes up kind of abruptly in Exodus 17.
That's what I was looking at. I mean, the people complain, Moses gives them water. I mean, I'm not talking now about the spiritual issues. And Amalek comes in, we can say it's because they didn't trust the Lord and so on and so on. But the reality is, if you're asking the question, why does Amalek come in? These guys have not only taken over the spice route and everything that you're saying, but they've also now got water to boot. So their whole farming and whatever is going to be on the increase. They're going to be doing even better. Isn't that a possibility?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then we have, in Numbers 21, we've got the king of Arad, who for, seems like, no reason comes out and also attacks Israel as they're coming towards him. I'm going to suggest Israel is definitely spreading out. They're farming all over the central Negev, moving into the northern Negev, and it's his job to protect. This would be roughly where Arad is located. Obviously, that's not accurate because you can't see it like that. Arad is like one of the central entry points into the hinterland of the country of Canaan, so it's his job to protect trade routes and so forth, access routes. So the king of Arad, Numbers chapter 21, he also comes out and attacks. And I'm going to suggest Israel is taking over the Negev full on, what we call the central Negev today. All right, so there's a practical reason behind some of these passages. Helps to answer a little bit, like, why Amalek comes out, why the king of Arad comes out. And you had a question?
I missed a couple of questions. And I missed the connection. I didn't follow how you established that they were farming. I understand that they were stuff from all over the place, but was there a particular crops that they had?
Yeah, we've got things like, you know, beaten olives, clear oil for the tabernacle, Exodus 27:20, fine linen, mentioned purple, blue dye, scarlet dye.
So they were growing it, and
I'm sure a lot of material comes out of Egypt. When they come out, they take their pay, what is due to them after 400 years of slavery. It's not really just plundering.
What you're really saying is what you were saying before was they've been given instructions that when you plant trees, you're to leave them for 3 years, and on the fourth year you can pick the fruit, and on the fifth year you can start eating them or whatever all the rules are. And when you do this, you're to leave the land fallow for 7 years, which is saying that they're farming.
Well, that's what that's my second question, because there in this period of time where the cloud and or fire, when
they
moves, they move. Right. So if they're in the middle of, wait, I can't move yet. I got these trees going on here, you know, or I've got this crop going on here. So that's my question of, are they just purchasing this stuff, or are they actually cultivating
they may even be taking over farms that already existed. Mm. There's very strong likelihood that these farms already existed well before the Israelite wanderings. If this soil memory business is accurate around Arad, even Arad would, but Avdat.
Well, because didn't you also, when you didn't they do an experiment on some of these farms that you were working in, and you guys planted on some of
we
these
planted ancient soil? Strands of grain, but that all came from King Tut's tomb.
No, but didn't you plant in some of that soil, and they found that because the soil was ancient farmland, it was rich in nutrients, like.
That all the scientific and the lab stuff I didn't have access to. I don't know all the results of AIDFARP, but
I thought I had read or heard that somewhere that because some of this ancient farmland was farmland, it still had nutrients in it, and that it was especially good for farming. Unlike where you just go into the negative and have to start from scratch.
Right.
But maybe
we also know, don't we, that the land, if you read through masses of scriptures, we know that the land of Israel, from north to south, was really well forested in many, many places. And then you get the 400 years of the Turks when they put a tax on trees and all the trees are cut down. So the land becomes desert. So we tend to think of the whole situation in what I call post-Ottoman Turk times, that the land is desert and there's nothing there. But it seems to me it's very reasonable that 2,000 years ago, whatever it was, people were farming as best that they could, whether it was olive trees or whether it was vines or whether it was runoff water or whatever it happened
to be. Until the next siege.
Until the next siege,
and
yeah, but it was there.
I'm not suggesting at all that they got more rain at that time. Runoff agriculture, you don't need much rain.
Yeah.
You capture everything that flows and you get it
but
in the
wadis. The truth is, the more trees you have, the more rain you get.
But even in Abraham's time, they dug wells and they battled over wells.
Yeah, but they also sat under the tamarisk trees and whatever.
So right.
So, is it the question of the law code issues aside, is it possible that most of the products that we mentioned, the carnelian, the cinnamon, the whatever, we're assuming they're getting them all from being on one of these access points of one of these international trade routes. Is it not possible that some of the other products like that they're using for the tabernacle, like the oil, like
right.
other incense things, that instead of growing all the zaitim, that they're just
intercepting it?
Same thing. They're just intercepting, because that's what you do when you have an international trade
right.
route. You sit on it and you move around on it and you tax whoever you find.
They're pirates.
Right. That's one side of this little. This is just I'm here for karmic relief, okay? That's one side of this karmic relief, is to just say Israel is intercepting the spice wealth, and that's one reason why they're being attacked. But then alongside of that, there's a factory going on. They're creating all kinds of things for this tabernacle that aren't necessarily part of this spice route, like wheat and growing, you know, olives, olive oil. This Exodus 23
even
and all
those things though would be moving along that route, though. No,
I'm sure olive oil is moving along that route, but we also have to feed a lot of people. We've got to take care of a lot of things, not just manna. There's a lot of stuff. You've got to grow things for your animals, your livestock. There's a lot of practical things we're just not told, but we've got hints. And so I'm going to say from Exodus 23 on, you've got all kinds of references about how you deal with your crops. It doesn't make sense. It's a bit too early, in my opinion. I realize all the rules for living and behavior, social dynamics, those are all being set in a brilliant way in the Sinai Wanderings. But I'm coming, we need to finish. So I'm going to throw out one quick thing. How much time, this is a trivia question, how much time is Moses given to cut out the second set of stone tablets? God did the first set, but Moses is given a certain amount of time to cut out the second set of tablets. Trivia. A, 40 days. B, 3 days. C, 1 day.
I thought it was 40, but never mind.
Either 3 or 1. Because you gave this to us before.
I know, this is
you mean it, but now look where we are.
Look where you are.
He was saying just cutting out the tablets or writing them.
No, this is not writing them out. This is just cutting them out.
Yeah, cutting before he...
Cut out for yourselves 2 stone tablets like the former ones. And I will write on the tablets, although later on you find out that Moses is doing the writing. I will write on them the words that were on the former tablets, which you shattered. So be ready by morning.
Okay. Oh, one day.
One day or less. Okay. If we have the Israelites down here, it's like 98% granite. Granite and hard sandstones. You don't cut out stone tablets in a day. I'm being a little bit, this is a little facetious maybe of me, but you don't really, with bronze tools or even stone tools, granite on granite, you're still not going to cut that out in a day. I don't care how big they were. It doesn't really matter. But conceivably, if you're in limestone zones, you possibly could cut something out in a day. So just that one little hint has my whole, I pushed the Israelites out of the Sinai. The Sinai. It doesn't matter to me where they are necessarily. I just don't think they're in granite zones. Although copper is listed as something that the land contains, and really the only big copper mines are down on the edge of the Sinai. So that throws a monkey wrench a little bit into this. But anyway, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. That was kind of the subject. And the reason I'm on this subject is because just less than 2 weeks ago, I was at Miletus and taking my kids around. And we went to Ephesus, you know, we went to a few places. Priene is actually one of my favorite little spots, and had my kids look for what we're told is a synagogue. And it probably was, because there's a menorah, and usually that's part of a...
It's way down the hill there.
It's way down the hill, but I'd been there 20 years ago, and... couldn't remember exactly where it was, so we explored. It took us an hour and a half to find that, and it was a lot of fun. So we were at Miletus. About 243 BC, King Seleucus II, Callinius, offered the god Apollo at the temple in Miletus precious metal, frankincense, perfume, incense, myrrh, and anointing oil, and he also included gold. And there's this idea that those kinds of gifts are for the gods. Those kinds of precious things, very expensive things, are something that you give to the gods. And there's this verse in Isaiah 60, when describing Jerusalem's glorious restoration, Isaiah tells of nations and kings who will come and bring gold and frankincense, and shall proclaim the praise of the Lord. So this spice trail, this spice route, it's all over Scripture. New Testament, Old Testament, it's all over the place. And
I love it.
Once you smell it, you can't forget it.
That's the time we all went through.
No, I didn't bring my... I used to have a little kit of frankincense and myrrh and curry and cumin. And I don't know what has happened to it. It's so my visual aids, my show and tell was partly missing.
What's the relationship of basalt to granite? I don't know.
Basalt is also igneous. You're asking a challenging question because I'm not a geologist.
Isn't basalt still volcanic?
Basalt is volcanic. There's different layers, there's different levels to igneous rock. Really been heated up and morphed into something else. And then there's rock that's just been heated but hasn't necessarily melted. So I would say, well, obviously I don't know the specific differences between basalt and granite.
Granite is one
that's heated up
very, very much. It's one that's had its chemical formation change the most, right? Like you said, there's the several levels of, because it's.
But I would say basalt stone is something that has changed the most.
Yeah.
I think it's been.
Isn't basalt, if it's volcanic, it's being changed and it comes up. Oh, I don't know. Yeah, they're both been heated, but they're different way.
Basalt stone is a pretty consistent texture, color.
Basalt.
Whereas granite is
pressurized in different ways, and not, I think, at different times. I don't think it sort of happens in a moment. Whereas basalt, presumably, is every time there's an eruption.
That's lava that's dry, right?
Right, but doesn't that become basalt? Isn't that what basalt is? Well, lava that's dry.
Right.
Well, there's also tufa. There's also, you know, all kinds.